Session number 27075, Reel 1.
Gordon Leader Leggett, Reel 1. Gordon Leader, could you tell me when and where you were born, please?
Yes, I was born at Wembley, Middlesex, on the 14th of February 1921.
And could you tell me what your father did for a
living? My father was an electrical engineer at the British Thomson & Houston Company in Neasden.
And your mother?
My mother was a hard-working housewife who brought up four children.
So you had brothers and sisters?
Brothers and sisters. Elder brother died last year. I'm number two. My sister has just recently moved to Tiverton in Devon, having lost her husband a few months earlier. And my younger brother Geoffrey lives at Rottingdean with his wife. And he informed me yesterday that his son Nicola and Nicky, who lives in Devon, Dartmouth, is getting married in a couple of weeks' time, so it's of course for a celebration there.
And what about your education? Were you educated in Wembley?
Yes, I was educated at Wembley, at Wembley Hill School, and then went to the Hawker Aircraft Company on what today would be called a sandwich course. I certain time spent at the Technical College, certain time spent in the factory, which would be a program in the various departments, finishing in the drawing office, where I intended to become chief designer of the company and replace Sidney Cam, who designed the Hurricane.
So what age did you actually go to the Hawker Company?
I was 16 when I went to Hawker's.
Prior to that, did you have any hobbies or sports that you enjoyed?
Yes, flying model aeroplanes, building and designing and building and flying model aeroplanes mostly, yes.
What did you build them off from?
Oh, balsa wood, lightweight tissue paper, which was then doped. We wound them up with a finger on an elastic, or if you had the money, you could have a little motor, a little power motor. But yes, that was an all-consuming pastime. I did a fair amount of skating at Wembley. We had two ice rinks, in fact, and so I did quite a lot of skating, and I was an ardent supporter of the local ice hockey teams. Yes, I think that about sums up my activities at that time.
Where had you got this interest in flying from?
I think probably the fact that I lived at Wembley, because only a few miles away, as you know, is Hendon, which was a very important airfield in those days, and where every year the Royal Air Force air display took place, and this was the highlight of my year, to go to the air display at Hendon, which was a wonderful event. And the remarkable thing is that almost the entire Royal Air Force of the day could be accommodated on that one airfield and put on this magnificent show. Years later, when I was working at the Air Ministry, I found myself in the car setting off for Hendon one day to do a bit of flying. And little did I think in the pre-war days that I'd ever drive a car through the gates of Hendon and climb into an aeroplane myself and fly it off somewhere.
What type of aircraft used to be displayed at Hendon?
Hendon, we had a selection of Avro Ensigns, some Chipmunks, I think we had a Harvard or two, that sort of thing, because although, as I said, the whole Air Force could be accommodated in Hendon, by the time we got to the post-war period, aircraft were that much, needed a lot more space. Sad to say, of course, Hendon Airfield is no longer, but we have got the wonderful museum in its place.
And when you were a young boy, the aircraft that you were watching then, would were you, did you like fighters or bombers?
Oh, yes, yes. My boyhood aeroplanes, as I said, Hendon was the near airfield, and the Auxiliary Air Force used to fly from there. They had, I think, 600 and 601 squadron. They were flying things called Furies and Demons and all the wonderful old silver biplanes which Sydney Cam designed. Also, there was not far away Northolt, just to the west of Wembley. And there, during my younger days, were stationed Bristol Bulldog squadrons. And indeed, just before the war, in fact, in 1938, the first Hurricane Squadron, 111 Squadron, was formed at Northolt. So all this air activity used to take place very often over my back garden and received quite a lot of my attention.
And that obviously gave you a very early start in interest in aviation.
Oh, indeed, yes. And in addition, my family had a seaside home at Shoreham-by-Sea, and we used to go down there for our long summer holidays from as far back as I can remember. At Shoreham, as you may know, there is an airfield, which in fact was one of the world's very first airfields, with a fantastic history. And from there, there was a flying club, the South Downs Flying Club, which used to operate Avro 504s. And my brother and I had had our first flight, in fact, in an Avro 504 at Hendon. Cost my father half a crown each. The pilot was none less than Pashley, Cecil Pashley, known as Pash, who was a flying instructor after a career in the First World War as a fighter pilot. And he went on to become the world's leading aircraft flying instructor. I forget how many, I think it was something like 30,000 flying hours. I might be wrong on the figure, but some fantastic number of flying hours went down to his credit. He died, I think, about 5 years ago. Anyway, it was he who gave me my first flight.
And how did you feel about that first
flight? Oh, quite fantastic. Yes, it was an open cockpit, of course. Strictly, it was only a two-seater. It was with the instructor in the front and pupil in the back. But for half-crown purposes, they put an extra seat in the back so you could get two people in the back seat. And yes, it was. Mind you, the thing only it was only in the air for a couple of minutes, but it was quite an experience. Yeah.
And how did your friends take to that? The fact that you
my brother. Oh well, he was enthralled as well, but he never became air-minded. He was all into wireless and electronics and that sort of thing. But yes, he was very impressed with the first flight.
What year was that you did?
That would have been 32, something like that. I was probably about 11, I should think, yes.
So I take it there was never any doubt which direction you were going to take?
Oh, no, right from the outside. My father wanted me to be an architect, but I wasn't the least bit interested in bricks or mortar, and aeroplanes were the thing. I told him I could be an architect after I was retired if that's what he wanted.
Obviously, to go to Hawkers, was there anything that was required within your education to go and work at Hawkers?
No, not that I'm aware of. It was arranged by my father, in fact, with the company. I don't know what the arrangement was. I merely expressed the desire to go and work at Hawkers, or indeed De Havilland's, but Hawkers came up trumps, and yes, somehow he arranged it with the company, but I don't know the details beyond the fact that I was told to report there and get on with it.
And what year would that have been? Hmm? What year was it that you went to Hawkers?
Well, that would have been, I was 16, so that would have been 37, yes.
And can you tell me something about the company at that time? How large it was? What the premises were like?
Rather primitive, I would say. It was, of course, Established during the First World War as Sopwith Aviation, owned by the great Tommy Sopwith himself, of aviation and yachting fame, millionaire. So it was created during the First World War, and by the 30s, of course, had become somewhat dilapidated, if not overcrowded. I think probably overcrowding was the main thing. Everything was bunched in very, very close together. All the machines were close. And in fact, going through the machine shops was quite hazardous. Everything was so close together, you had to be darn careful as you moved around. The facilities for building aircraft, assembling aircraft, weren't terribly good. There was only room for half a dozen aircraft on the line at any one time. During the First World War, of course, there was the much bigger works at Ham, but that had gone to Leyland Motors, had taken that over. As it happened, many, many years afterwards, they were building Hunters in that building. And then, of course, there was Brooklands, and there was this crazy arrangement where all the bits and pieces for airplanes were manufactured at Kingston-on-Thames, put on lorries, and trundled all the way down to Brooklands to be put together and flown and flight tested from there.
And what were your duties as an apprentice? What was the first things you were involved in when you arrived?
Well, I was put to work with a skilled man, we were building. Two-seaters for various countries. In fact, we had orders from Sweden and Spain. In fact, we built Furies, which was the single-seater biplane fighter. We built Furies for the Spanish Civil War. We also built for the Yugoslav Air Force, as it was then. And then, of course, the Hurricane came along, and the first production Hurricanes were assembled and shipped off down to Brooklands.
So what were you doing on these when you were with the skillman? What were the type of jobs that you would be working on when you were working on?
I'd be given a drawing and some bits of metal and told to make that. Which I did, not terribly accurately. I'm quite sure half my output was tossed in the waste bin. So I'd be doing that. Or indeed, I'd be given a bit, and again a drawing, and said, "Now go and bolt that on there." So I'd bolt it on there, and the inspector would come along and see if I'd bolted it on properly. It was all very interesting. Of course, I was able to spend quite a lot of time sitting in cockpits, which is my favourite pastime. I was fairly, without a parachute in the seat, one goes down very low into the cockpit. So I was able to get in the thing and disappear inside it, and spend an amusing time flying the thing around the hangar.
And what would the cockpits look like in the biplanes? Because I imagine cockpits have changed somewhat over the years.
Not all that. Well, yes, recent aircraft have, of course, with all the wonderful gadgetry they have today. But in those days, no, they were fairly primitive. There was nothing cushy about a fighter aircraft's cockpit. There'd be levers and lobs and things all over the place, and you could quite easily give yourself a nasty bruise on something or other. They weren't terribly comfortable. But interesting, of course, because it seemed almost real sitting in the thing.
And what kind of production runs would occur there? How many would you be making, really, for all?
Well, yes, I would think the Spanish Furies, I think we had six. There was the Swedish Osprey. I think we had three of those. They weren't big runs. It wasn't until getting close to wartime that production was stepped up. But by that time, of course, we were tending to run down production for other air forces, because quite clearly we're going to need all our capacity for producing the Hurricane.
When you were doing the production orders for other air forces, would there be a special adaptation particularly for say, the Spanish Furies or the Swedish Ospreys?
Yes, the most obvious thing, of course, would be the labels for everything, which would be in the language of the country. Mm. Because in those days, unlike today, not many people spoke English outside these islands.
And hawkers would provide that on their boats?
Oh, yes. Yes, the engraving shop would be busy engraving all these little bits, all these labels that went all around the cockpit indicating this, that and the other.
Mm. And at that time with the Hawker biplanes, was it much of the same type of biplane that was adapted for different roles, or were they specifically designed as a fighter or a...
Well, the Fury was a fighter, single-seat fighter, with two machine guns. The others were all adaptations, which started with the Hart, which was a two-seater biplane. Pilot in the front and the gunner in the back. And the and that had two machine guns firing forward, and the gunner in the back had a Lewis gun on a mounting, and he sat out in the open. He didn't have turrets in those days. Although, in fact, the very first turret did appear. It was designed by Fraser Nash, the motor people, and we put that turret into the back of a Hart. I don't know whether it was successful or not, but it wasn't a turret as we know it today. It was a metal thing with slots in it. Otherwise, we went on from the Hart, and then we've got the adaptations. There was one called the Demon, which was a Hart strengthened up for dive bombing. There was the Osprey, which was for the Navy. All the metal work had to be treated with anti-salt water preparations. That was the Osprey, and there was also the Navy Nimrod, which was their version of the Fury, again modified for sea use by the Navy in salt water conditions. I think there was the Hind and the Audax. Again, it was an adaptation of the Hart. And the Audax was modified for the army, principally the use of fixing of a hook underneath the fuselage, and the hook had a bit of string on it. And when the aircraft went over where the army were, they would have put up a message on two poles with a bit of string strung across like a washing line. And the pilot of this aeroplane had to fly towards this, lower his hook, and grab hold of the message, and pull it up into the cockpit and read it, which probably says, "Hey, come home, it's time for tea," or something.
So I take it at that time, how would communications occur between the pilot, say, and the rear gunner?
We had what was called Gosport tubes. It was just an ordinary speaking tube. It had a mouthpiece in the front at each end. And you just blew down it and passed your message. And it worked all right, yes. Of course, radio was only just coming in. I think I'm right in saying some of the Furies had the TR-9D transmitter receiver, which we had in the first Hurricanes. Terribly primitive thing. But I think they were just beginning to be introduced. Again, on an experimental basis.
You mentioned a couple of things there with the Demons. You said it was strengthened for diving. Mm. How was it strengthened? Was there anything you would do?
I think probably in the metalwork in the wings, the construction of a wing would be a main boom running the whole length of the wing longitudinally. And then at 90 degrees to those would be set the spars. They'd be, what are they called? The spars? Anyway, they were at 90, whatever they were called, they were at 90 degrees to the main spar. And then the fabric would be stretched over that sewn in place and doped, and there you had a wing.
And the demon was strengthened within the spars.
That's right. Yes, the spars probably were of a heavier gauge metal, and no doubt the rigging was that little bit more sturdy. Because there were all these biplanes, of course, were all held together by bits of wire and string.
Also, you mentioned obviously with the Nimrod and the Osprey that they were naval aircraft. Mm. Were they for aircraft carrier use?
Yes. Yes, they were.
Would they be strengthened or have any adaptation for, apart from the obviously the corrosive?
Yes, again, they would have had the hook under the fuselage for landing, because that's how the Navy worked. They aim the thing at this tiny bit of metal and pull the throttle shut and pray that the hook will catch the wire going across the flight deck. Yeah.
And with the hook, obviously, it's attached at the back of the fuselage or in the fuselage. Mm. Is there anything? Is there a strengthening spar there or bolt or something?
I dare say there would have been. I'm not necessarily aware of it, but I would think almost certainly it would have been strengthened up to take the shock. Actually, it amazes me, a modern aircraft, as you know, they've come bombing in at these carriers at the most fantastic speed. And really, when that hook does gather, it pulls that aircraft up with such a jolt. The pilot, of course, and indeed the entire crew, have to get themselves well and truly strapped down before they make a landing. They do come at a tremendous speed, and the forces involved are really quite considerable. And it does amaze me that the thing doesn't tear itself apart sometimes, that they get away with it.
With the biplanes that you were working on, what kind of performance would they have at speeds? And
ooh, I think they probably used to trundle along at about 160, if that. About 160, I dare say. Mm.
Also, when you were working on them, you mentioned the experimental Fraser-Nash turret that was placed in there. How was that powered? Was it a hand?
I'm not sure that it was powered. Yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't know. It would have been, it would almost have certainly been electric, I would think. But I think it's more probable it was manual. I don't think so. You probably had to wind handles. Actually, I didn't get involved very much on that. It was going on in the erection shop, as we called it. It was just there. It was a point of interest, but I didn't actually work on it myself.
Was there a lot of experimental work going on, though, at the time?
Well, across the road in Kingston, Canterbury Park Road, across the road from the shop we had, where we were putting together these various aircraft, was the experimental building. In the year 1938, we started putting together the first Typhoon, which in those days was called the Tornado. And this was the successor to the Hurricane. It was a single-seat fighter, very much bigger. In fact, by those standards, it was huge, much bigger than the Hurricane. It had a Rolls-Royce Vulture engine, which was two Merlins put together in X formation. You got two Merlins driving the one air screw. Following on from that was the that was going to be the Tornado. Following that on from that was the mock-up of the Typhoon, which was going to have the Napier Sabre engine. This again was 24-cylinder engine, 2,000 horsepower, the same as the Vulture. The Sabre, in fact, went on to become widely used by Typhoon squadrons particularly during the run-up to the invasion and the invasion itself. The Vulture engine, unfortunately, the Vulture engine was not a success. And indeed, the Tornado wasn't a great success either. And that so that was pushed to one side, and the whole effort went on to the Typhoon, which of course did come turn out to be a first-class ground attack aircraft, a typical Sydney Cam, built like a battleship, really robust. It carried four Machir, four cannon, and rockets of various sorts under the wings, and was, of course, as we all know, was used very, very effectively against targets in the invasion of Europe.
You said that the Vulture engine wasn't a success. What were the main problems with it?
I don't know. I think it was probably something to do with the gearing, because you were gearing two engines together onto a common crankshaft, you see. So I think that didn't work out too well. It's been tried by various other companies and different aircraft. The Brabazon, which was a huge, monstrous, great thing with engines everywhere, that was a case where two engines were geared onto one propeller, and also the big flying boat built by Sarrow, the Princess flying boat. Again, this was engines geared together. I think they worked up to a fashion, but I think they were prone to give problems.
I'm interested, obviously, in the amount of time that it takes to get an aircraft from the experimental stage, obviously, into the trial stage and flying.
Mm.
Because at that point, up through that period, you're actually working on biplanes, mm. but the mock-up was something like the Typhoon.
Mm.
Which, how long would it take to get an aircraft to an operational squadron, really?
From the drawing board, or yes, from the drawing board to an operational squadron? Well, inevitably, the time got longer and longer as the years went by. Now it's some you're almost into decades. Going back to the First World War, I think they could get them in the air within a few months. Then gradually, as time went on and they became more sophisticated, more and more things were added, and the time span gradually stretched out. Now the Hurricane, I think from the first prototype, which first flew in 1936, it would have been 1939 before 111 got their first aircraft. It was, I think, the latter part of 38, early 39, I think. Before the first Hurricanes got into the squadrons, yeah.
Because you mentioned something of Sydney Cam's ethos as a designer.
Mm.
Was he building, you said they were like battleships, was he building that specifically for the military aircraft to take punishment or to be hardware and endurable?
Well, I would think probably a bit of both, although obviously you wouldn't build an aircraft in wartime with a view to it having a long life necessarily, because very often it probably wouldn't have a long life with development moving so fast. An aircraft very soon became obsolete and had to be replaced. Lost my track there.
About Sydney, we were talking about Sydney Cam's ethos. So.
Oh yes, that's right. So no, he would have built it to do the job it was designed for. Now, just when rocketry came onto the scene, I'm not sure. Certainly, I wasn't aware of any provision for rockets when we were building the prototype Typhoon at Kingston. So his design would have been for a single seat fighter mounting 420mm cannon. That was its role. Designed to operate at all altitudes. Now whether there was a glint in his eye and he saw it as a ground attack aircraft, I don't know. In which case he'd have undoubtedly put additional strength into it for that reason. But it was a fascinating period, of course, working on those prototype aircraft. In fact, one day the the experimental shop manager. I was lounging against the bench, I think, and he came over with a big box and put them down on the bench and said, put them in that engine, will you? I looked at the box and looked at him. There's a whole lot of sparking plugs in there. And I said, put the sparking plugs in the engine. That's right, he's gone, can do it. He said, you'll find a little plug in each hole, take that out first, and put the sparking plugs in. Well, listen, it caused an uproar. The trade union officials got to hear that this student had been given the important job of putting the sparking plugs in the one and only voucher engine in existence. He'd probably wreck the whole thing. I did it, and it all sizzled down there. It might even have been that wasn't the one and only voucher in existence. I'm quite sure that must have been some others. But I've no doubt if I'd double-threaded some of them, there'd have been a bit of a row. Just